Disclaimer. The views and opinions you hear expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Show tapes live some Thursdays on YouTube, channels A and N Zach. Check my Twitter feed, ActionZaku, for more. I hope you enjoy the show. Hey, everybody, welcome to ANCAST. I'm Zach Burchie. Jacob Chapman is here.
Hey, folks, using the full name.
Yeah, I usually just say Jacob's here. Yeah. How you doing?
Pretty good. I got a bunch of eggs. What is the meme? Is it eggs or oranges? Like, I have, like, I can't hold all of these things, but it's got a lot going on in April. Basically, we're preparing a whole bunch of features and stuff, and
yeah, as we speak, in my team of convention reporters is infiltrating both SakuraCon and Anime Boston this weekend, and then you and I are spending this morning like getting the preview guide ready to go. That launches on Sunday, So get ready for two solid weeks of like six shows a day,
right? And a big feature right after that I'm really excited about.
A lot of stuff, yeah. We got a lot of stuff coming up. Mm-hmm. You got a big project you're working on too.
Yes.
And I do too. And all kinds of fun stuff. It's going to be good. There's going to be a lot of good stuff. But there's a lot of stuff to talk about, I feel like, because the winter season has wrapped up. And then we saw some movies that are strangely both directly relevant to this podcast for once.
I guess so, yeah.
Yeah, they are. And similar, weirdly similar in some ways. But we'll get to those a little later. Let's talk about anime up front. Winter's wrapping up, which means my beloved Pop Team Epic has aired its final episode for now. Mm-hmm. Do you think it's going to come back?
No, I mean, I thought it was a really good ending to the show. It was big and stupid, which is kind of exactly what I want from Pop Team Epic, so
yeah. Yeah, right. I definitely want more, but, you know, like, that's the thing. I feel like Pop Team Epic has already told me what to expect. Mm-hmm. About half great.
Yeah.
So, actually, I would say about 10% fucking sublime.
Uh-huh.
10% the funniest shit I have ever seen in my life. And then 40% great fucking jokes.
Uh-huh.
And then 50%
meh. Yeah.
And that's a really incredible ratio for a comedy. Like, for a sketch comedy, that's phenomenal.
Uh-huh.
I loved Pop Team Epic, and especially the opening theme.
Yeah.
I can't wait for more. But who knows if they'll make it. If they don't, it's fine. Like, those the episodes we got were great.
You know the lyrics to the opening theme?
I mean, no, I didn't.
Oh, they're really existential.
Cool.
They're, like, really gruesome and, like, you know, navel-gazy.
I like it.
Yeah.
I like it.
I figured you would like it more knowing that.
Yeah, that makes me like it more.
Okay.
Oh, Pop Team Epic, I'll miss you. But I will probably go back and watch that Hell's Chicano bit at least a couple times every few months, because it's really good. You watched a lot more shit than me, including After the Rain, which wrapped up.
Yes, and thankfully it did not stumble the whole way through, because I felt like that's all we had to hear about was just like, well, the premise is gross. I'm like, well, theoretically, but the actual execution of it isn't. And I finally got to the end of it, and yeah, it did not stumble at all once. The show was very confident in what it was doing with that premise the entire time, and it was really good and really thoughtful. And I would say, I guess the one issue that you might have with it is it is very low-key. It's very subtle. It's about, like, sort of, I don't know, like, difficult but not, like, big melodramatic emotions that these characters have to process and then move on from. So it's not, like, you know, it's not a big melodrama. It is a quiet, like, this is a story where the main character, the main girl, like, just doesn't talk about her feelings ever at all. She never says how she's feeling, period. And it's just interpreted entirely through the environment and through the people that she talks to, and you got to pick up on it. So it is, like, subtle town, you know, despite the really bold, beautiful color scheme and the gorgeous art and, you know, the flourishes, it's the actual writing is just extremely low-key. So if that's not your thing, you know, then you might not want to watch this. But, like, anybody else who wants, like, a really thoughtful, subtle character drama, like, this is great, and it looks great, and it had a really strong ending, and you know, it made me really happy. There were like moments in that where people have conversations that it's like, oh, I haven't heard that like said that way before. I said this of Scum's Wish too, which is also had this quality, only Scum's Wish was way more melodramatic, obviously, but it has this quality where people have conversations about stuff where it's like, oh, this is a thing that I've struggled with, or a way that I've like, it's a relationship that I've had with personal passions of mine that's gone awry or whatever, or ways that I've projected my emotions into a situation where they weren't relevant and stuff like that. People just talking about stuff like that, that it's like, oh, this is really refreshing and grown up and thoughtful, and I like seeing that angle. So, yeah, if After the Rain's premise skeeved you out, which is, need we remind everyone, 17-year-old girl falls in love with her 45-year-old boss at a diner, it is not even remotely skeevy. It's really clever. I would highly recommend you check it out. It is actually not a love story. It is a rebound story, I guess you could say. And yeah, check it out.
That's a really interesting perspective, too. You don't see that very often. Yeah. It's exploring emotion, like complicated emotions in nuanced and interesting ways that it's completely unexpected, I think.
Right. It's two characters rebounding. Their connection is rebounding from a breakup with not a person, but the love, the passions of their lives, whether it's literature or running or being an author someday or running track. And due to an injury and just like, you know, the failures of his of how hard it is to become an author, like they both had to fall out of that and then like attach to each other because they were both going through this grieving period for that. And yeah, so it's not actually a romance. It's like, surprise, it's a bait and switch about these more complex issues. So, and I guess that's why that manga, you know, won all these awards and stuff and people are talking about it, but it's really great. You should check it out if you like that kind of thing.
Yeah, cool, man. I intend on going back and catching up on it pretty soon, hopefully in the next like couple of months before it totally vanishes.
Yeah,
from
it will
memory.
Vanish.
But
yeah.
I really loved the way it looked, so I know I'm going to go back to it because the aesthetic haunts me. I keep thinking about it, like, yeah. Yeah, anything else, like, really standing out to you that ended that you're like, yo, check it out?
I don't think this, I think that this, this show's star rose very progressively over the past several weeks, so I'm not sure it needs, like, another cheerleader, but I was really impressed with the way that Antarctica Girls ended. Because I was a little softer on it earlier in the season, but now I'm having seen the end of it, I was like, yeah, all right, that did build to something like really strong. So definitely check that one out if you need another person telling you to watch A Place Further Than the Universe, which is the full title. Everybody just that I know just calls it Antarctica Girls, but it is technically called A Place Further Than the Universe. Yeah, that right. One did some really neat stuff as well.
Yeah, you were talking a lot about how it, you know, every episode had kind of this sort of treacly emotional climax.
Right, which is not my bag. I was like, okay, this stuff is good. Like, I like high emotion melodrama stuff, but I don't want every episode to have this giant emotional climax based on, like, I made a friend. You know, like, I don't.
You're saying I don't have to be afraid?
Yeah, that kind of thing. So that's what a lot of the first half was, and I, you know, and it was good, and it was like, okay, this is coming from a place of sincerity, but eh. But once they make it to Antarctica, it starts doing that with like more emotions that I don't see expressed very often that are difficult and aren't like portrayed that way. Like for an example, so this is a minor-ish. I mean, there aren't minor characters because there's only four of these girls, but this is one of the less focused on ones throughout the show's run. Who, as it turns out, went to Antarctica, joined this expedition just because she wanted to get away from the world because she had just, much like After the Rain, like she had just lost her connection to her life's passion. It was like it was an athletic team. I don't know if it was track. I think it was like track and field, but I can't remember. I'm pretty sure it was track and field. That's why it gets mixed up in my brain with After the Rain. But basically, this character was like sort of quietly bullied and ostracized out of her track team due to a misunderstanding that was like turned against her. Basically, it was completely unfair. It was very like realistic, subtle portrayal of like how these things kind of tend to happen. People kind of get othered out of a group over dumb high school bullshit. And so she goes to Antarctica, and then there's like a live stream where they're showing everybody, you know, hey, the girls made it there, and isn't this neat? And the girls who bullied her out of her track team show up on the live stream and are like, and they have like this thing, they're like, oh, we're sorry for the way we treated you and we really want you to come back. And it was like a public sort of apology, and she doesn't know how to react to it. She's just really angry, but she has to hide that. And so her friends stick up for her and do something that I don't see. Like normally in these kinds of shows, what you would have is the character like has to be the bigger person and forgive them. You know, like, maybe they're happy to forgive them if they're sort of like a pure star child like that, and they're like, oh, it's okay. And if they're not, if they have more complex feelings on it, then they, like, have to be the bigger person. And in this case, like, before she can really deal with having to suck it up and say that, because people are watching her, and what is she going to do, tell these girls to fuck off? Her friends step in and tell those girls to fuck off. They're like, you know what? She's not responsible for making you feel better about the bad way that you treated her. That is on you. You have to deal with the consequences of that. You can go fuck yourself. And, like, it's not that strong a language, but she does say, like, I think, screw yourselves. Like, she's harsh. And it was like, oh, wow, I don't see this, you know, I don't see this kind of emotion elucidated in these kinds of things very often. Usually they're like, oh, you can be the bigger person. It's like, you know, there isn't, forgiveness is not for the people, it's for yourself to some extent. Like, forgiveness is a process you have to go through on your own. And if you're just giving it to people, then you're just basically saying there aren't any consequences for there are no emotional consequences for me, and you can just beat up on me and I'll take it. And, you know, to some extent you have to be able to say no and put your foot down and be like, hey, you're doing this for attention on a giant live stream, so I'm going to, on a giant live stream, tell you to fuck off. So that was really good. And then the thing that I won't spoil, which is the actual grieving process that the main character has to go through once they get to Antarctica, to the place where her mother died, was also really impactful and thoughtful. And I was like, okay, I wanted more of this maybe in the early going of the series, but now that we're getting in the back half, like, you know, I'll take it, definitely. It was like, okay, this show really came through near the end. Toward the beginning, I was like, all right, the levels of emotion it was reaching with the struggles that they had at the beginning didn't match, but it starts matching near the end.
Okay. Yeah. All right. It was very thorough.
Sorry, I was like, well, let me talk about this.
Yeah, no, it's fine. I will probably never go back and watch the whole thing, so I appreciate the thorough sum up. Well, I just don't have the patience. Like, yeah, it might come to a really cool emotional climax, but and actually that's a blanket statement that's not true. Like, I may have the patience for it at some point or be in the mood for it. I have to be in the exact mood for something like that, and I'm not in the mood for it very often. But everyone keeps talking about how that one's, like, really good, and I do keep a little list of shows like that for, like, when you're in the mood, check this one out. So I've put this one on that little list.
Yeah, well, and if I wanted to nitpick, like, even the stuff where it's like, okay, this is a thing that you would attribute a lot of emotion to, I think they attribute it almost too much to. So even then, it's like, all right, you know, it's a little bit much. It's a little melodramatic, love livey, treacly for me. But, like, it was a good, well-written show, well-produced, like, you know, I understand why people fell in love with it.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. All right, well, unless there's something else from Winter, then I think we have to just get on to our contractually obligated,
right,
required by law, Darling in the Franxx discussion.
Franxx cast.
This is just the Franxx cast. Now, every single week, we're just going to talk about Darling. Actually, you know what? I feel like I can hear our listeners just the minute that every single week we're going to talk about Franxx. And just
it's
start.
Like you just announced a pop quiz.
Yeah. Yeah. Heavy, ragged sigh, which was kind of my reaction to Darling in the Franxx this past week.
I mean, at least woke people up, because the last couple weeks were kind of like, all right, I'm just fatigued with this. I want it to get to the point, and like, yeah, I guess this happened. It wasn't very...
There was one episode that was kind of a complete waste of time, and then there was another one that was where the shittiest kid gets out into the...
I don't think he's the shitty... Is he?
The kid who's like, I don't care about anything except, like, my id. He just announces that his stupid id is the most important thing at any moment.
I think he's the most enthusiastic about growing up and pleasing. He's the most into being a robot.
Nah, he's got that stir. That is a, like, an anime personality type.
It is. He's Genki.
Crossing his arm. No,
shitty,
he's not.
He's shitty Genki.
He crosses his arms and he's like, I don't care about this, or like, we should all do that. Like, he's really like little masculine, little toxic masculine guy.
Oh, okay. I remembered his motivation mostly just being like, I want to pilot the robot harder than anybody and become an adult and please the king or whatever his name is. I forgot the name for their...
But
like,
he has the cross-armed,
he's shitty, but like, that's because he's 13. You know, he's
okay, but
he's
that's
a
like, what I'm saying is that is a certain type of character.
Yes.
I usually don't like that type of character.
he is obnoxious.
I feel as though this is an attempt at saying that he's just like all the other characters.
No, he's not. I'm not. I'm just saying he's very ambitious, I guess this is.
Yeah, and but he's super cross arms, heh, and I don't like that. Yeah. I don't like that. Anyway, the shittiest kid gets out into the main city and kind of sees how adults live in this horrible dystopia. That there was a little bit more of the thematic, because all you're waiting for at this point is for them to get to the fucking fireworks factory.
Drop the shoe.
I don't need any of your other antics. Yeah. I only want to know what you're trying to say. That's my entire interest in Darling in the Franxx in the first place. It's not like the world building is like super compelling or anything. You know, it's interesting-ish, I guess, but like, they feel like elements that have been sort of, we've seen rearranged over and over again. Here they've been rearranged into this configuration. And as always, the point is, what are you trying to say? It's always, and I'm impatient at this point, because I feel like maybe this shouldn't have been 26 or something. Maybe it couldn't have been done in 12, but anyway, so this week's episode was another one where we're dealing with side characters. But this time, they got into some sex and gender politics that were sort of shitty, as usual.
Questionable, at the very least.
Yeah, yeah. Well, see, that's the thing, right?
I have questions. That's what I mean.
Well, it's always, and like, a lot of the Twitter questions that we're getting now are basically like, why are you still talking about Darling in the Franxx all the fucking time? Like, that's a lot of the Twitter questions that we're getting.
Oh, really?
And it's like, it's because it gives you something to talk about. And there are things in here to dig into. Like, we probably would have been the same way about something like Argento Soma, but some other, like, Ava alike, where there's a lot to dig into. It's trying to say something big.
Yeah, it's trying to do a lot, regardless of how good or bad it is at that. If it's trying to do a lot, you have something to say.
Yeah, and I really like engaging with stuff that does that. Mm-hmm. I like that a lot. That's my preferred way of engaging with media, is something that asks me a lot of questions, and I think about it and engage in conversations about what I saw and what I thought it was trying to say, good or bad. Like it or not, if something is trying to say something, I will engage with it. You know, like, I'm going to try and figure out what it's trying to say. That's like almost the chief way that I interact with art to begin with. So yeah, it's fascinating to me when something is attempting something like this, and we dig in deep.
In the tier, like, the tiers of Ava Alikes, I would say Darling in the Franxx is like maybe among the least thought-provoking in terms of, like, get to the fucking point. It's so slow-paced.
Well, I thought about this a lot, probably too much, and, like, why it's getting such a reaction. Not to like, condescend to people of, like, oh, this is why you have a strong... I'm just saying, like, I think there's a key difference between Darling in the Franxx and Evangelion that makes it more prone to these kinds of analyses. And it's its own fault. Evangelion is about feelings. It's about depression. It has the sense to focus on Shinji and his depression. And by episode 12, it might not be clear that the entire show is chiefly about depression, but you get a sense that this show is chiefly concerned with Shinji and his feelings, and that Shinji could be a stand-in maybe for you. You, the viewer, or certainly the director of the show.
Right, yeah.
So you know you're watching a show about the director, in a way. Darling in the Franxx, the entire premise is...
what's going to happen? Ooh.
Well, no, that's not what I was going to say. Yeah, you're right in that it could be kind of... it is kind of a mystery box, and it's just trying to keep you guessing. But the show is... the way that its premise is set up is... it's trying to prescribe things. It feels as though it's hard to interpret it not as though it is trying to prescribe things to society. It's not about one character and his feelings. It's not about, like, it's not executed in this way that allows you to isolate what it's talking about something that's personal or just emotional or empathetic or something like that. No. This is like, here's a problem. You know, these are all these societal problems that mirror things that we talk about in the real world. And the way that the setup is, that's what it's projecting onto. is like society should be this way. It's prescriptive for, you know, members of society who are this way. They interact with it, and there are fundamental, like, natural laws to things, like, oh, only certain types of ladies get along with certain types of guys, and certain types of this and certain types of that, and these are the important things for the furthering of the species.
And not, like, developing the characters, like, through this process.
And not developing, and by all, through all of this framing, what you get is what you're sitting here waiting for Darling in the Franxx to tell you is who's worth continuing the human race and who's not. Fucking eugenics. That's what eugenics is.
Right. And we're not saying that the show is eugenicist. We don't know. But the problem is it's taking so long to get there that it's like, you better not.
No,
you know?
It's the problem is that I don't think that the show is doing that. Straight up. I don't think that that's what the show is saying. I think it keeps stumbling into framing things that way because of its premise. And I don't think it's very responsibly written. You know, I think they, unless that is what they're getting at, unless they are going that way, this is a pretty, you know, it's kind of irresponsible to frame things this way, because unless you want people to be like, yeah, I'm going to think about society as though I am the judge who gets to determine who's worth existing and who's not, who can participate in a meaningful way in society and who cannot, based on my personal judgment of your physical and mental attributes, that's fucked up.
Yeah, well, and the problem is the show is almost half over, basically half over, and we don't really have, we know what the fucked up system is, but we don't know anything about the world outside of it. I mean, beyond the very basic, like, yep, that seems like the dystopia I expected to see. So we don't really know we don't see, like, conflicting values with what the system is to an extent where we can predict where this is going and feels very good about it. It's not like, oh, this is the obvious hell system they must escape from. It seems like they know something that, like, the system is also reinforcing to be true. So we just don't have enough information to say, like, where is this going? It just feels like, okay, it's saying shitty things without explaining why they're shitty or even if they're shitty, you know.
Absolutely. I think that's a very good summary of kind of what the issue is, and it's just a feeling. That's just how it feels, and what I am hanging on to with one, like, white finger, one, like, there's no blood left in it. I'm just hanging on to the edge of the cliff at this point. Is that this entire setup? Is that all of these kids are being manipulated into all of this by Gendo Ikari-type figures.
Dr. Franxx.
By Dr. Franxx and this council of elders that has manipulated all of society into this function. Everything that's happening, they are being manipulated into it. Now, the show very much could still be about smashing the entire system, freeing all these children from this system, setting them free, basically. It could still be about that. It could be about rejecting all of this social programming that they're being given, all of these insinuations about who's worthy and who's not. It could be about breaking all of that and saying, all of this is the adults. We have to make our own future. Now, that's a super common theme in a lot of stuff right now. That was the theme of Shin Godzilla, right?
Yeah.
Like, breaking. So it's not totally unreasonable to sit here and say, like, oh, shit, they're going to say, like, no, burn it all down. If that's the message of Darling in the Franxx, I'm on board. I'm still on board with it. But
it is that vision
is getting increasingly obscured by the decisions that the show makes, including the ones that they made in the most recent episode.
Right.
Which involved clearly gay kids.
Right.
Clearly gay kids being put into some pretty awkward situations. Can you kind of run it down?
Okay, so to my recollection, although most of it was spent saying, oh no, honey, what are you doing? The episode starts out focusing on Mitsuru, who is the biggest dick, because I think you were saying Zorome is the biggest dick. He's the most annoying one. Mitsuru is just an asshole. His entire role in the show up to this point has been to be angry, reject pilots, and, like, try to take other people's pilots and try to become the best and show up hero. And so we find out that he's gay, or at the very least he's queer to some extent, because the way that this is framed is, like, as a child he wanted to pilot the Franxx with Hero and soon learns that he cannot. So, you know, interpret that however you want. And doesn't seem to have any luck with his female partners, you know, interpret that however you want. So, Basically, the name of the episode is called Partner Shuffle, and so it's playing directly into kind of what Meetzer wants, which is to partner up with somebody who's more compatible with him than Ikuno, who is his absolutely, definitely, 100% a lesbian partner. I don't know why they thought they would solve the problem of the two gay kids in the heterobot by sticking them together, because that doesn't tend to work. You know, it's like, well, I know that, you know, these queer thoughts can be confusing, so here, we're gonna partner you with somebody who has no sexual interest in you whatsoever. That'll make it more confusing. You should have paired him with, like, somebody who likes boys, so at least he could be, you know... I'm just saying, like, if you're gonna try to crush out the thoughts, maybe there would be, like, a better way to do that. But whatever. So they stuck the two gay kids together. It's not working. They're doing a partner shuffle thing. And Futoshi, who is the, hefty lad, the chubbier of the bunch, has gotten really, really attached to his partner, Kokoro. And he, sort of, like, I guess forces a marriage proposal on her, and Kokoro's personality is basically just like go along to get along. So she's just like, yeah, that sounds nice, but she's, you know, overwhelmed by it and not sure about it. And Kokoro has been having, this is where the episode gets a little eugenics-y. I think by accident we're going to charitably say, but Kokoro for the last couple episodes, ever since the beach episode, has been having feelings of like maternal longing. Like she doesn't know what it is because they haven't really been taught about that sort of thing. But like she senses like this desire to raise a child, and so this maternal longing within her, you know, her biological clock has started or something. And so she's looking at Futoshi and she's thinking, nah. So she wants to try partnering with other people to see if it changes her mind or she feels differently. So she decides to partner with Mitsuru, who is totally down with this. And Ikuno decides that she wants to test if a Franks can be piloted by two girls. So she grabs Ichigo and they all do the partner shuffle. And Futoshi is heartbroken and Mitsuru is still an asshole. And Kokoro is self-hating about the fact that she, quote-unquote, led the boys on. And the lesbians aren't happy either. You know, it's just a mess. And so basically there's a lot of different partner dynamics going on in the episode. It's kind of hard to break down. But there's a conflict of feelings about it. Because on the one hand, it's very sympathetic to all these characters. It's sympathetic to Futoshi for feeling bad about his weight. It's sympathetic to Ikuno and Mitsuru for their unrequited feelings. Like, it's sympathetic to all those characters. And yet... it is not arguing necessarily the validity of their feelings. It's just like, yep, this is a grieving process that you have to go through before you, you know, move on. And that's not cool. So I think that the reaction that I was seeing to that episode is, on the one hand, people were way more engaged with the show than they had ever been before. They were like, oh, something to talk about. Oh, these characters actually got development for once, and I can kind of discuss this. But on the other hand, I think there was... even though the show hasn't given us answers for these things, like, intuitively, I saw a lot of women and queer viewers and, you know, viewers who were overweight and stuff like that said, intuitively, this bothers me. Like, this bugs me. And I don't necessarily have a strong reason why, because we haven't, like, the show hasn't said anything firmly about this, but all the things that they're suggesting give me the squicks. Like, give me the I don't like where this is going reaction. And I definitely had that reaction myself. So while it's very sympathetic to all these characters and the struggles they're going through, it does feel like they are being put through a meat grinder slowly, and I don't like it, and I just want the show to get to its fucking theme already, like, to get to its point so I can know whether or not I agree with it or not, because it's not giving me a whole lot to chew on otherwise. I'm just like, oh, that's nice. You introduced gay characters, and you introduced the idea that this kid's weight might be a problem for him, but, like, not in a way that makes me comfortable. I don't know.
Here's my question about this. Why, if Futoshi's weight is a problem, and what they're saying is that he can't, like, the pilots won't be as attracted to him.
Uh-huh.
Why would they recruit him for this program?
Maybe he was really compatible. Well, they said it was based on compatibility, right? And
so they were like, shrug?
Well, I mean, the answer is maybe the writers didn't think hard about it. But these characters,
I think he was written in so they could write a bunch of fat shaming.
Yeah, and same with the gay characters. It's like, well, if this is a disqualifying thing, if this makes it more difficult for you to resonate with an opposite sex partner, you think they wouldn't make it through the process? Yeah. At least with me, like, so with Ikuno, we don't have an answer, but with Mitsuru, we actually do have an answer for that, because they do say, like, he wasn't compatible, he wasn't going to be part of the program, he actually underwent an operation that injected him with these yellow blood cells, which is the thing that makes you you know, Franksable. And
yeah, which okay, so he gets injected with a drug that makes him just not gay enough to get into
whatever
a
that means, right? I don't even know what that means.
Well, is that what they're implying there?
I don't think so, because it didn't change his feelings, it didn't change his mind, it just shortened his lifespan. So I think it just means that it's just a
see
device.
You deny who you really are, and yet
it's a
all this
it's a
fucking
device,
shit. It is impossible to sit there and not think about this stuff because the show is so like, it's so like, what are you fucking doing with this? Mm-hmm. So you got to sit there and think about what it's saying, what it's implying.
Yeah, but I mean, like on the plus side, this was the most that I had ever come to care for any of these characters. I felt for Kokoro.
Oh yeah,
I've definitely been
totally.
In her situation. I've been in Futoshi's situation. I mean, not literally, but I like
Mitsuru. I have been personally in Futoshi's situation, and admittedly, my reaction to Futoshi was like I would have held him down and punched him in the face.
Suck it up, Buttercup.
Suck it up.
You know,
you didn't like that girl owes you nothing.
Yeah.
Don't project your self-worth onto the girl.
I agree with you.
That moment where he was like, let me finish. I mean, I have been in that situation before, but like, you know, like the minute he started going into this scene where he's like, oh, you'll be with me forever and ever, right? Like trying to get this, like, I really need to feel like someone needs me forever right now. Confession out of her, and like it was clear she didn't want to do it, but she makes a mistake and says it anyway. Like that stuff just gave me flashbacks to like this dude has to be broken of the idea that his save, like he's gonna find self-worth in another person. Like he has to be broken of that. The show is not interested in exploring any of those ideas.
Right.
But that's my reaction to seeing those scenes. I can't help that.
Yeah, no, I understand. I felt bad for him because I thought, like, this is, first of all, he's like 12 or 13, right? And this is his first heartbreak. And I didn't think that, like, he's not in an age where he can be aware about the self-esteem that you, like, that's more high school.
No,
when you
I'm
start
not.
To become
I'm
aware.
Not.
Let me finish. That's more like high school where you start to become aware of that. So he's too young to kind of encounter that. So most of his emotional reaction is just going to be like heartbreak, basically, and not being able to deal with it and being angry as a result of that. So I felt for him. But like, yeah, if he gets to a certain age and continues to kind of have that entitlement and that coming on too strong toward his partners, that would definitely be a problem. My brain didn't go that far with it because people were being exceptionally shitty to him. So I was more angry at the other boys for treating him the way that they were. But like, it's just kind of a complicated situation, and I felt sympathy for everybody involved. I felt angry at the show and sympathetic toward the characters. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, totally. The episode did make me feel more sympathetic towards the characters. I liked a lot of them more at the end of it. Yeah, like, it's such a thing. Like, I said I would watch this all the way to the end. I definitely will. And I really am hanging on to that idea that, like, okay, this whole society is a manipulation. So, when, you know, that's a huge asterisk on anything that it's saying right now. Anything that it's saying is, like, all these emotions, everything, they're all being manipulated into this. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what... Where's it really going?
Right.
I do want to say that, like, I think we will limit, we'll try, unless there is something like, holy shit, we have to talk about it, we'll try to limit the Franks chat to every other week. Mm-hmm. Or so. Anyway.
I mean, it's about been that. We skipped a couple weeks with other podcast stuff. We're just skipping the podcast. So, you know, like, we do our best.
Only when there's a thematic development that's important. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Right.
I promise.
I will say the thing that I think gave people the GBs, they were like, well, I like this on the surface, but I'm uncomfortable with it, is that episode does end with Mitsuru, like, finding solace and letting go of his attachment to Hiro through the love of a girl. So, you know, what are they saying with that? Like, are they saying something insidious with that, or are they just talking about him letting go of his unhealthy attachment? Or did they cure him of the gaze, or is it just an emotional, like, maturation point? Like, we don't know, because Franks is not very clear about these things.
Yeah, there are a couple things that give me pause about the reading. First is that the one girl is like, this would have worked if you'd have been into it, basically. Like, I didn't get to test my theory because
the two
you
girls,
didn't try.
Yeah,
the two girls. That means that I think they're not shutting off the idea that they've all been manipulated. Like, that's the thing. All of this is manipulation. The Franks system is designed to only be piloted by a boy and a girl. Like, they have not tried that yet. So I'm holding out a little hope for there. And it seemed to me, I read a little bit into Mitsuru's scenes as being, there is also societal manipulation happening here. He has been manipulated into denying who he really is. And that is, thematically, it's touching on that. Uh-huh. And that it's a bad thing for him, that he's denying who he really is. It's not saying that it's good, that it's a good thing for him. So while it could totally go into the standard bullshit grief, well, I'm mourning the fact that I'm gay, but society won't let me be who I am.
Or you just, more often, it's like I've accepted about this about myself, which means I won't ever fulfill it. Yeah, I won't ever fulfill it. This is a sacrifice I have made for society. That's usually where it goes.
Yeah, okay.
Or they kill him.
if that's the direction it goes. Yeah, actually, I do think he's marked for death, though.
Really? I don't know about that.
A lot of these kids seem marked for death.
Oh, so Kokoro is definitely going to fucking die. I'm going to call that right now. So I think Kokoro is going to... I think Kokoro is going to be the one who is responsible for revealing the... This is a guess. This is completely based on...
Berserk mode, like, partly.
Yeah, so I'm like, oh, it's going to be her.
And it's just fucking Berserk mode, by the way.
Yes, they just copy the exact...
Beast mode. Anyway, go on.
What do they call... I'm forgetting the name of the monsters. I know it's... Klaxosaurs. I think that the Klaxosaurs... If the Klaxosaurs are a Franks that basically desync... Like, my guess is that the Klaxosaur is going to be a Franks where the woman took too much control and went berserk. Because that would be... That just seems like where it's going. And if that's going to happen, I think it's going to be Kokoro. I think Kokoro is going to be the first to go because she's really sweet and she is... and she puts on a facade for people so they will like her, and she's got like hyper baby making please love me obsession hormones in her brain right now, so I think that's what's going to happen to her.
The Klaxosaur is a rampaging beast that is a baby crazy lady who went unfulfilled for too long.
I don't know.
Could you imagine? I'm guessing.
Oh. The one they destroyed has little babies in the second episode.
There was one shot of Mitsuru. That's his name, right? I'm not getting it wrong.
Mitsuru is the gay kid.
Yes. Mitsuru, where he's in the pilot, he's in the cockpit with her, and they have this moment back and forth, and she's like, all right, let's get to work. And then the lights on her ass light up, and then it's like a fucking landing strip of lights up her back, and then it cuts to him with this kind of sort of look on his face, and I was like, barking up the wrong tree there. It was
you're not here.
It was funny.
I'm gonna say Kokoro is doomed and will be the one that like reveals the twist. As there's always like a person who dies who reveals the twist in these sort of things, you know.
Yeah, probably. That's a good prediction. Let's see how... Maybe we should do a thing like we do a show of Darling in the Franxx sealed predictions.
Right.
Where we try to predict the last half of the show, and then when it's over, we open up the envelope. And you know what? Let's do it. Let's do that. I'm going to set that up.
I think Ikuno will survive, but I think she's going to do the tragic lesbian thing.
Probably.
Zero two will start to go berserk again, and like Hiro, like... transcends his physical form in some way. Like she starts going
berserk, and he's the one who has to control her. It's his calming presence that makes it work.
Yeah, well, that's already happened, but he has
like on a huge scale. Like,
yeah, well, that disease that he has is going to fundamentally transform him into something like her. Maybe he's going to grow horns. She's the red oni, right? So
yeah.
Anyway.
Oh yeah.
See what I'm
seeing.
Boy,
you're just fucking predicting all of it.
Well, I could
just
be wrong.
Write it. Just write it.
I could be wrong about all of it.
Those scripts are like
these are my
what?
Guesses.
20 pages.
These are my
25
guesses.
Pages.
Okay, so one more. So I think Dr. Franks' goal is for the basically to get one of these Franks pregnant.
Yeah. No, that I think is pretty obvious.
Yeah, but I don't know with what. I don't know what he wants to come out of that. So, it's like, what would a mech give birth to? But so we have these female mechs.
We're going to find out.
Yeah, but Franks wants the synchronization with these things to be like 500% or whatever, so it spits out a baby.
There's
going to
be a birthing scene.
Yep, it's going to happen, you guys. Who knows beyond that, but those are my guesses based on
there's going to be a Sakuga, like, right up the canal.
Ugh. The exhaust port.
Shunt. Darling in the Franks, chat is finally over for this week.
Anyway.
Let's talk about some movies we saw.
Yeah.
There are two movies, actually surprisingly kind of connected in one way. In one unfortunate way, they are connected. The first one we saw was Wes Anderson's Isle of Dogs, which has been, you may have seen, a lot of discourse about this film. Mm. And we saw it, and I really struggled with this movie. I went in with a very open mind. Now, mm-hmm. just want to say, like, I love Wes Anderson and have for decades. I fell in love with Rushmore like everyone else did back in the 90s, and just he was my favorite director for... a part of the 2000s, and he made I think he's made a couple of masterpieces. Like Rushmore is one of my all-time favorite movies, same with Royal Tenenbaums. I think his best movie is Fantastic Mr. Fox, which a lot of people agree with that, and I think like animation was a natural fit for him and his style, his mercurial little shadow box kind of style. You know, he made like three really great, he made one terrible movie, The Darjeeling Limited, which was terrible because it was a bad movie that just repeated all of the themes from his other films, and C and B was pretty racist, like
so Isle of Dogs
unintentionally racist,
right?
Like I don't think Wes Anderson is a racist. He just used the entire country of India and all of its people as this backdrop for kind of this sort of these three, you know, bougie fucks, idiot fucks, kind of roaming around figuring out how to deal with life after dad, and like. Right. It's, you know, it's in, it's just kind of this insensitive sort of shitty entitled portrayal. It's not like, oh, what a fucking racist, but it's just,
yeah, it's just
unfortunate.
Like,
yeah, it's unfortunate, shitty, like, you know, I don't really know exactly how to describe
well, look,
it. Except
Wes Anderson
to say,
is the widest person on the planet.
That's the common problem.
It's not like, oh, he's horribly racist. It's just that he's so white you can see through him, and so he's gonna make dumb.
He lives in a very odd bubble.
Yes.
A very specific bubble. And so he made this film, Isle of Dogs, which is another stop motion film, which I was very excited when it was announced that he was going back to stop motion because he did so well with Fantastic Mr. Fox. This is a film about Japan. The country of Japan, unfortunately, is set there. And it's about 20 years in the future or so. And it's a sort of totalitarian kind of future, sort of very authoritarian. According to the premise of the film, a disease is plaguing the dogs. And so the fascist government sends them to a trash island out in the middle of nowhere. And then a foreign exchange student comes in and solves everything.
Well, she a foreign exchange student who exists to fall in love with the main character, who is a Japanese boy named...
Atari. His name is Atari, and he crash lands on the Isle of Dogs to rescue his beloved dog, Spots, his bodyguard dog. This is the ward of Mayor Kobayashi, the evil Mayor Kobayashi, who has concocted the entire dog flu because... He hates dogs.
Because he loves cats.
And he loves cats instead.
And his sidekick is a lurch-like figure named Major Domo.
Major Domo, who looks like looks like a ripoff of the Gegege no Kitaro guy, who I'm, of course, blanking on his fucking name right now. Mm-hmm. But he looks like an illustration by that guy a little bit. It is a Japanese horror stereotype.
Right.
But the whole film... So the decision was made here so that the Japanese language in the film, which is there's plenty of it, is not translated directly. It's always presented via these audiovisual gimmicks like a translator or there will be text on the screen, but it'll be coming through like a machine translation or something like that. Like it's always basically there's a barrier between you and the language. Now, the dogs in the film all speak perfect English and do not understand Japanese, in spite of all having been born and raised entirely in Japan by Japanese people.
Right. Okay? Spots understands. Everybody else doesn't for some reason.
Spots for some reason understands, but he's like Special Forces.
He's Special Forces dog.
Special Forces dog. They introduced this foreign exchange student, a white girl named, I don't remember her fucking name. She has this giant, you know, cutesy perm. She's voiced by Greta Gerwig, of all people.
It's like, what?
Greta Gerwig, of all people, comes in, like, Noah Baumbach's ex-wife, or his current wife, and, like, Wes Anderson's longtime collaborator. Anyway, she shows up. And solves the entire thing herself, and is slapping Japanese people and yelling at them
well,
and being
the
super
lady
forceful.
She slaps, I want to
yeah,
really emphasize
go
this.
Go ahead, yeah.
Is so of the, so there's two girl dogs, and then there's two female characters. One of them is, the one who gets the most to do is this Greta Gerwig character, and the other female Japanese character is a lady scientist named, so there's a scientist who's like the one rebellious force of good who's defending the dogs, and he gets taken out or whatever, and then, spoilers, I guess, and his lady scientist, who was in love with him, because that is the role of all four female characters, is that they're in love with a guy, and that's the reason that they're doing stuff. Her name is Yoko Ono. She is voiced by Yoko Ono. She has three lines, and her entire role in the movie is her scientist husband dies, and then she needs to be told by the foreign exchange student to do her job while being slapped.
Yeah.
That's her role.
Yeah, it sucks.
It was bad. Anyway, but you said earlier, like, you summed up the Darjeeling Limited with, this was a bad movie because it repeated ideas that Wes Anderson has done better in his previous movies, and it was racist. That's what Isle of Dogs is. The ideas that in it are just like watered down, less interesting versions of stuff that he's done in his previous movies.
Well, and it's just like this, like, cringy fucking, like, JPN 101 travel brochure, the broadest possible conception, American conceptions of Japan, cranked up to a cartoon. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of, like, the audience that we saw this with laughed at people responding in Japanese.
Yeah, just
because it's
delivery.
Played for laughs. The entire language is essentially presented as a running joke. Mm-hmm. There's the mayor's evil plan is to gas all the dogs with poison wasabi sauce.
Yeah.
There's no Love Hotel joke. I was fucking shocked.
Yeah. And well,
there's bullet train jokes.
To give you an idea,
there's
like,
a lot of characters that look just straight up like racist caricatures.
It's a weird.
The little hacker kid. Hacker kid looks like
Who has no lines
looks like a racist cartoon. Yeah. There was a Vice and Luna strip where we had a little Miyazaki figure.
Uh-huh.
And the way that I illustrate that comic, I don't illustrate it. I describe what I want. Uh-huh. I use reference images. I give them to the artist, and the artist does something up. The first draft that I got back, the face on it, I don't necessarily think anybody else would have interpreted it this way, but I saw even a hint.
Yeah, like
a hint.
Tiny
like,
bit.
Oh, this looks a little off. We need to be careful with this.
To make
had
sure
it completely redesigned so that it did not even remind me. I should not, like, that should not come into my head. Uh-huh. You should not be reminded of race when you're designing something like that. You should not be reminded of racist stereotypes.
Mm-hmm. Of something that would be in a Bugs Bunny propaganda cartoon.
Real people. You base your designs on real people. Mm-hmm. These are just racist. It's just racist.
Right. And it's not that the whole thing is like, it's not like it's overwhelmingly racist or
no,
that
and I don't, yeah,
talk about.
It's such, you gotta
it's
be
just,
nuanced about
here's,
this.
Here's
stuff.
A description. Like, so there, we see, you know, Grand Leader Kobayashi sitting in, a room that is nothing. So there's a giant folding screen with a painting on it. This is the pastiche. It's a giant folding screen with a painting on it, and he's sitting in a hot tub that's like hand, you know, that's like manually heated with coals, and it's this tiny thing in this giant room. And he stands up after washing, and he's got a giant Yakuza back tattoo of a cat. And the person changing his water for this antiquated hot tub in this room is a geisha in full makeup. And it's like, none of these things go together. Like, these are all Japan things you've heard of from Japan, but creating this, like, oh, this is a cute little scene requires, like, all these four or five things that don't go together in the same shot. Like, they're from completely different. My brain was like, what? That's completely different elements of Japan that don't go together in a shot just because you've heard of them. Oh, and his bodyguards in the scene, I believe, directly following that are sumo wrestlers. They're just.
Yeah, his sumo wrestler bodyguards.
They were shown competing, and then they're also his thugs. Like, what? Huh? Like, it's just things in Japan that go together. And so he's not, like, trying to be racist. It's just this weird, like, cartoon pastiche of very basic stuff from Japan that doesn't go together.
You know, and
like, what?
And, you know, and my first thought in all of this is, like, okay, what do Japanese people think about this? And there's an excellent article on Vulture. I would go recommend it. I will link to it in the show notes for this one. I think that's the definitive article you should read on this, where, it is an overview of that subject and a very good discussion of the issues in the film. Like, I don't think you should take my word for it or Jacob's word for it. I think you should watch this thing for yourself or don't watch it, but definitely read this article.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the perspective that you want, is that article on Vulture.
Right, and it's not overwhelmingly negative. They're just like, this seems like it was not made for Japanese speakers. Like, it's just, like, totally in Japan, but seems like it's made exclusively for people who don't understand what they're looking at.
No, but I think that's the perspective that you want on this. Like, right? You're listening to this show right now. You're listening to me. I appreciate you entertaining my opinion on this, but I think you should read this Vulture article.
Right.
But the other thing we saw, and I'll get to the weird connection.
Okay.
Steven Spielberg's Ready Player One.
Not as bad as I thought it was going to be.
Not anywhere near as bad as I thought it would be.
Not good.
But almost, yeah, that doesn't mean it was good.
No, but
it was not good.
I was expecting, I've seen excerpts from the book, which, look, I like reading books before I go to see the thing, even if I think it's a bad book.
I feel like
not get through Ready Player. I couldn't do it.
I feel like we don't need to recount.
No, we don't. I'm just saying I couldn't read it.
The horrors of Ready Player One. I feel like if you've been listening to this show for any period of time, you would know what my reaction to Ready Player One is, what Jacob's reaction to the book Ready Player One would be. Like, in fact, you might be upset with us for having seen the film in the first place. You might be like, what the fuck, guys? Like, you're giving money to this shit? First of all, I use MoviePass. Second, we had friends who wanted to go, so, you know, we always take that invitation. But, I mean, I was curious, of course. It's Steven Spielberg. I've been seen every movie he's ever made. I'm going to watch this one, too. And what I my main takeaway from Ready Player One was that this was a movie Steven Spielberg made for nerd parents my age. Mm-hmm. So if I had children, this movie, and like owned a lot of Funko Pops, I would take my kids to see this movie. My 10-year-old, 12-year-old kids. It's PG-13. There's some swearing in it. Like, it's got a little bit of an edge to it in the way that Amblin movies in the 80s had. And so it feels like that's what he's trying to make. It is devoid otherwise. There is nothing else to it. It is just a, I thought, particularly kind of crummy-looking theme park ride that... It, you know, hammers on these nostalgia points as plot, basically. I didn't care for it. I was done with it after probably about an hour, but it wasn't like totally like, oh, I'm so miserable, I want to leave. I was just like, all right. Yeah. The experience was virtually identical to the feeling I get when I've been walking around the San Diego Comic-Con exhibit hall for too long, which is, literally, it feels like all of your holes are just being stuffed with advertisements and marketing and brands.
For sure.
You're being pickled in brands. Mm-hmm. You're just drowning alive in it. And that you, and it fills up your lungs and you can't see anymore and you can't think anymore and your brain gets cloudy and all you can, and it's just this swirl of brands is horrible. Like you're being flushed down a toilet of brands.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the movie felt like.
I know what that is. I know what that is. I've heard of it.
But you can't, but in my opinion, the CG, maybe you didn't think this way. We were sitting like a little far back from the screen.
Mm-hmm.
The CG was so like that kind of rushed feeling. I don't know how long they spent on it, but it feels like it was rushed. It always seems like that's the problem when you see bad animation, basically, is like they didn't have enough time. But like this had that weightless, you know, cell phone video game cutscene Marvel CG look. Like, you know, third act Marvel fight, the stuff they didn't quite have time to finish, the really weightless video gamey looking shit in Marvel, the whole film is like that. And the references, if they were there in the background or whatever, they were, you could point them out if you were had a freeze frame or whatever, really paying attention. But everything goes by in this like weightless blur and you don't. Like, none of it, not a lot of it registered.
Yeah, well, it wasn't nearly as bad as, like, a Transformers movie or, like, some of the worst parts of a not particularly good third act of a Marvel movie. It wasn't that bad, but it was, however, not stylistically interesting. Like, the Battletoads look exactly like the guys from Halo, look exactly like the Iron Giant. Like, and I'm not talking about, like, their shapes or designs, obviously. I'm talking about, like, the aesthetic, the way they move, the color scheme. Like, you know, when you go into VR chat or whatever, or a modded game, like, there's art styles that are just incongruous.
Yeah.
And it that would make more sense, right? But that's kind of that's the Ready Player One experience adaptationally. Under the surface, under the hood, they're about the same thing. They made a lot of plot changes, like a lot of plot changes. But under the hood, you're not fundamentally changing the appeal of the story very much. It's a nerd handy J no matter what you're doing.
Yeah.
But like,
Ernest Cline's version is more world-building intensive. It is more like, you know, TV tropes, full list of all the how my universe works sort of thing, or Sword Art Online, you know, if you prefer. Actually, I think it's way more detailed than Sword Art Online, which cares less about that stuff than a lot of isekai MMO stuff does. But where was I going with this? But the movie irons all of that out and makes it so the technology doesn't make sense and is more like... Let me put it this way. The 5 years have passed since, like, the challenge was issued, and then they figure out the challenge and move on to the first step of the, you know, the thing that will then be solved completely in 36 hours. But the answer to the first challenge that nobody could figure out for 5 years, speedrunners and, like, game modders and stuff like that would have found that within 5 hours.
That really threw me.
2 hours they would have fucking found that. So it's, you know, and I assume, I haven't read the book, I've just seen excerpts, but from what I understand, the challenges seem like more like stuff that would take longer to figure out and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So basically the technology and the way it interfaces with our world and stuff like that is completely no. It's,
well,
you know.
Yeah, there's a lot of weird stuff like that in there, which kind of made it feel more like a kid's movie to me.
Exactly.
Like, which is fine. That's pretty obvious. That's the audience. He aged it way down. And I think that's appropriate. You know, like,
well, they're still, like, swearing and stuff.
Yeah, but there is in Amblin movies from the 80s, too. Like, that's...
Right.
That's, you
not,
know, Stranger
Things...
Doesn't Stranger Things have swearing?
Yes. No, you're exactly right. I just...
I'm saying they make these harder... Goonies. The Goonies. That's what the model is.
Yes. No, it is aged way down to be more family-friendly.
There's
than the book,
these movies...
However.
PG-13 movies get one fuck.
Yes.
And this movie has one fuck in it when there is an absolutely terribly animated Chucky that comes out, and he throws it out like it's a special item, and Chucky starts stabbing things, but it looks like Yoda in Attack of the Clones.
Yeah, it's a weightless, fully articulated tiny person instead of a doll.
That where whose limbs are just flying around in every direction, and you can't really make it out like what it's doing, except it's killing things. And one guy says, "It's fucking Chucky!"
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, "Hey, that's the one fuck."
Yeah, that's the one I get.
They used it on that.
Yeah.
All right.
It's not exactly a precision strike.
But, like, yeah, if you stare at the backgrounds, they'll be like, there's the Battletoads.
Yeah.
Look, it's Sanrio characters.
Yeah. And the Gundam, which got the biggest rise.
That was,
audience.
Okay, so
I don't know why.
I do, while we're in Los Angeles.
That's true.
But the, I do want to point out, there is one very good, cool part in Ready Player One, and that is very specifically Gundam versus Mechagodzilla. Seems as though someone put some care into the choreography and gave a shit a little bit about that fight being cool and good. And it actually kind of was. I was sitting there going, all right, you got my attention on this.
It didn't have the 70s anime, like, sound effects and grit to it.
I'm not expecting that.
I know. I wasn't expecting that either. I'm just saying, like, I wasn't. It didn't. Therefore, it did not.
Therefore, you didn't think it was cool. But I kind of did. I was, especially the way they animated Mechagodzilla, I thought was actually pretty neat and okay. That stuff was all right. I didn't hate the movie. I just didn't care about
it.
Well,
yeah, like, that's the
feelings.
Thing. I was expecting to be... They ironed out all of the... I mean, there's cringy dialogue in this, but they ironed out all of the weird, entitled, hateful, uncomfortable stuff from that book.
Yeah.
There are still problems.
Not all of it.
There are still problems, but it is not nearly as... Like, this is a thing that, like, you can say it's shallow in the way that it panders to... sort of nerd aggrandizement, like, gosh, we're great.
It's,
like, it is shallow, but
it's not say that. You should say,
right,
it is wildly shallow.
However, like, the book is not just shallow, but, like, militant about, like, you know, we're the chosen one.
Well,
we're
yeah.
better than all these other people. And the movie kind of ironed out that sort of hatefulness. And, but the really funny thing to me is that the book, all the way through, obviously, is, like, you know, this is the real world to us. Like, this is what really matters, and this is why we're great, and this is why we conquer the world by the end, you know, sort of a thing. This is why this belongs to us and not the corporations, even though it's a bunch of brands that are owned by corporations. You're not taking them for, oh, another corporation wants to own these other brands that also are owned by other corporations. Like, it's so frustrating. Like, it's all capitalism. Like, it's all marketing to begin with, dude. You don't own any of it, but whatever. My point is, that's the book the whole way through. The movie does that most of the way through. Even his big, like, are you ready to fight speech is that. And then the last 10 minutes, Like, literally, the denouement is like, but reality, and this is what the terms that they use, but reality is the only thing that's real. So you should, like, turn off the internet twice a week and go out in the real world. And, like, it just shoves that in there and, like, tries to make that its statement. And it's like, oh, that's Steven Spielberg. That's him, like, hey, kids, maybe go outside every once in a while.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Here are the stakes. the stakes are basically we have a microtransaction structure that works for us that everyone's used to, even though we're constantly referring to the ways that capitalism is completely destroying everybody involved with this, and like the rank and file people's lives are wrecked by it, and like you have to scrounge for pennies in order to continue playing, and there are people who live entirely just scrounging for pennies, and it's a miserable kind of existence. Mm-hmm. But like, well, maybe not a miserable existence, but like it's definitely shown as being like, well, this is an unglamorous life. Mm-hmm. But the only thing they're fighting for is we want to keep this, and the bad guys are going to come in and introduce a much more invasive one that also involves ads.
Yeah, like, oh no, advertisements. That's what we're fighting. That's the guy wants to add ads.
That's all the stakes. And the thing is that those stakes are never touched on again. All that happens is they win, obviously, and then in the end, Steven Spielberg messages like, brush your teeth, kids. Yeah. Also, hey, kiss a girl. Go outside.
Yeah.
Hey, turn the screen off, kids. Mm-hmm. And now have a good ride home.
Yeah.
That's pretty much it.
Yeah.
And I feel like this really weirded me out, because this is an entire movie where he casts his Steven Spielberg's fucking Moe, love of his life, Mark Rylance.
Moe.
Yeah, he's Moe for Mark Rylance.
Yeah.
He is, definitely. I'm going to make like a Mark Rylance hug pillow and mail it to Steven Spielberg. I'll drop it off at the Amblin offices out in front. Maybe he'll get my joke. But like the whole thing is this connection between the main character and this man child from 30 years ago, Mark Rylance, who is obsessed with all the stuff that I grew up with, or a little older than me, like 70s and 80s. Steven Spielberg is the purveyor of this shit. The connection between Mark Rylance and the main character is the connection between Steven Spielberg and Ernest Cline. Surely, thematically, he saw this in the material and thought, I could make a thing that is about this baton passing, this shared culture where this thing that's special to me, I show you why it's special to me, and then you take it and make it special to you in your own way, and you remix it and make it into a thing that's special to you. And look at this beautiful, the passing down of art, the meaning that it has in our lives, and the way that we imbue these things with meaning, and how they come to have meaning for us, and meaning across generations, even. Right. Those are powerful. No. Hey, those are powerful things, and like, it could have touched on all of that. The movie was like prime to touch on that.
It did not,
and it didn't even consider it.
No, it was just like, oh, this is nice. And now make sure that you go outside every once in a while when you're done playing your game, okay, Ernest?
Remember Adventure for the Atari 2600?
No.
I do.
I mean, I know you do, but I don't think a lot of the audience does. I think these are
and let me tell you, like, if you're a nerd in your 30s or 40s or whatever, and this is a movie where they're like, okay, we got to find out the one Atari 2600 game that he hid a secret in. First fucking game that... pick Adventure first.
Yeah.
It's probably an adventure.
Right.
That is probably the most significant and well-remembered Atari 2600 game. Also, like, the first in many ways. Give me a fucking break.
I should clarify. I don't remember Adventure. I never played it, but I know that piece of trivia.
Yeah.
And so they have, like, this giant boardroom. Again,
hundreds of dudes trying hundreds of games, and these scientists scratch, what could it be? Maybe it's, Buck Rogers. No, it's fucking not Buck Rogers.
Yeah.
It's Adventure.
It's like, all right, but again, like, since we've spoiled that, I'll also, just so everybody knows how dumb it is, the thing that it took 5 years for people to figure out that they couldn't get past to even start the challenge was in the big race, which is the first challenge, drive backwards over the starting line, and the level extends behind you. Speedrunners and modders would have figured that out in the first fucking day. They would have cracked open. Because they say that there's an active modding scene in this game. That Iron Giant that you see was made by the main character's friend, who obviously didn't get the fucking point of the Iron Giant, but whatever. Everybody's talked that point to death. But there's an active modding scene, even though like the mods are all like it seems like canon textures in the game. Like, there's no weird textures. Everything looks the same. Anyway, these people don't understand how technology works. My point is, so yeah, people would have cracked that. And they also have a thing where they hack somebody else's gears to show them something that's not really happening. So that's a big deal. So if you can do that, you can 100% crack open a level and look at the whole thing. And then if somebody had done that, they would have just cracked it open, saw the level extends past the start line and go, oh, fuck. Well, there's the answer to your question. Like, technology doesn't make any sense in this. But they added emotional stakes to this that didn't exist in the book. It's not just like, I know more pop culture than you. They just made it about, instead of I know more pop culture than you, they made it about, like, the emotional highs and lows of this person's life and what he wanted to communicate through those to a younger generation. So that's an improvement, but, you know, it was still, it's still just pennies. It's just like, oh, this isn't as bad as the book, but it's still dumb.
I just want to touch on this before we get to Twitter, though. The connection between Ready Player One and Isle of Dogs. Ready Player One opens with a cutaway gag sequence where it is portrayed like how much people are invested in Oasis and how much it matters to them. And when you zero out, quote unquote, it means you lose all the gold and items and everything. When you die, you lose everything you have. There's no corpse runs or anything, which is pretty brutal.
Yeah.
But it cuts to a Japanese workplace and there is a salary man who gets zeroed out and he goes, wah! And like rips all of his gears off and starts running for the window. They're in a high rise and he's going to kill himself. Because he's lost all of his shit.
LOL.
Yeah.
And also the Japanese character that, like...
Yes, and that's what I was getting to. So one of Ernest Cline's friends in the game... I don't know the main character's name. Parzival. P-A-R-Z... Yeah, Parzival. One of his friends plays a super badass red samurai guy, and his friend is a ninja guy. And when they meet the samurai guy in real life, his name is Toshiro, and he bows to you and has exactly. And then he's the guy who's like closes his
that is the only
down.
Line he speaks in perfect English and has like a native, like, oh, I grew up in America kind of accent, or at least, like, I lived in America for such a long time that I don't have an accent, but when he summons the Gundam, he just says in Japanese, his only Japanese line, and he still bows at people and knows martial arts, and it's like,
he knows
the
martial
fuck?
Arts and everything, yeah, it's, but the thing nerd. Is, the book was super shitty about that too, right?
The book was apparently 10 times worse.
10 times worse with this.
Because he was talking about committing seppuku and shit.
Yes. So... Hey, there's a fun connection for you for between these two films that we saw one after the other this week.
Turns out people are racist.
But here's the thing, though. I will say this. If you're like, oh, shit, I'm a bad person if I go see that movie. No, you're not. It's just a movie. The Gundam Mechagodzilla thing, if you're like, ah, fuck it, I'm going to get trashed and go see that. I wouldn't say, like, you're gonna totally hate the entire thing. You're not gonna be angry, I don't think. The Shining stuff might get you a little bit, but, yeah.
There's a level based on The Shining. We won't say a whole lot.
I mean, they
like
spend
that.
Half the time saying, this didn't happen in The Shining.
Oh, my
as if
God,
to...
I laughed. So, I actually laughed in the theater at that, where, like, so, obviously, this is modded level based on The Shining, and it's, you know, there's stuff that happens in it that's dumb. And a character, like, said, I think it's, yeah, the main character says, like, 2 or 3 times, oh, this wasn't in The Shining, though. Like, just letting you know, because they're like, we know you haven't seen this, like, 90s kids. And 80s kids, I guess, have seen it, but, like...
Would be sitting
would
there
be
tearing
like,
your
oh,
hair.
I'm saying that, yeah, you're right. This didn't happen. This is new information. Like,
whatever, Jacob. You know, I'm a fanboy. I know a hater when I see one.
Oh, no! That's a line from the film.
I wish I could remember the flirt line that really made me...
Yeah.
There was a line, but there's a flirty... Oh, let's, you know, one of those scenes where
his first flirting. Yeah, his first connection scene with his girlfriend is like just a series of them quoting references to each other.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah.
I love the Goonies.
Yeah.
Remember Highlander and Highlander 2? Remember Star Trek? We certainly do.
Ready Player One.
All right, let's take some Twitter questions.
Anyway,
Neil Nadelman, my pal, asks, we got into it yesterday on Twitter with Daryl, who was claiming that the, Pacific Rim.
We didn't finish it.
We walked out after 20 minutes because we were bored as hell.
I was like, this is boring.
I'm not watching the rest of this.
Yeah. I should clarify. I haven't walked out of a movie in long that I can't remember. I'm not going to go into detail.
But this is very important. Full context. MoviePass is a service where you pay $10 a month and can watch whatever you want in the movie theater. You can go to the movies once a day, basically, for free, if you pay that $10 a month. Well, you're paying $10 a month. But
$10 a month, it pays for itself if you see a movie once a month.
If you live where we live, where movie tickets are $15 a piece.
Yes.
So we go to the movies a lot and have gotten to the point where it's like, if I'm not feeling it, I'm okay leaving. Mm-hmm. And Pacific Rim, I was not feeling it. It felt like a direct-to-video Transformers sequel to me. And frankly, the response that I see on Twitter from a lot of most other people who saw it did not wildly disagree with me at all. They were a lot easier on it. Yeah. They didn't feel like leaving. I was like, it's a beautiful day outside. Let's go to the bookstore. I want to get some ice cream. Yeah. I want to go shopping. Like, let's go enjoy our Saturday.
What's the name of the new Star Trek that looks like Mass Effect?
Star Trek Discovery.
Okay, I felt like I was watching Star Trek Discovery on NBC, and I was like, why am I watching this in a theater?
I like John Boyega.
I love John Boyega, but
I didn't like that movie enough to sit there and watch just for him and his. And frankly, like in the first 20 minutes, all the performances were very bad. I was like, Boyega was like not very convincing, and I'm like, oh, all right, he's so cute. I'm gonna leave though.
Sorry, dude. But like, yeah, it was just it wasn't like, oh, this is terrible. Like, if a movie was terrible, I would stay. I left only because A, we had MoviePass, and B, like, I was just like, this might as well not exist.
Yeah, I also want to point
out, this is leaving my brain as I watched it. It was so bland.
Yeah, there was no point during Ready Player One where I was like, I want to leave.
No, not at all. I was thoroughly entertained by how dumb it was.
Yeah, I mean, or Isle of Dogs. Like,
Isle of Dogs was gorgeous. I know you weren't as into the visual aesthetic.
I thought it was a missed opportunity visually. Mm-hmm. Like,
no, I loved it visually. I just didn't like the story at all.
You knew literally anything with stop motion it's boxes of garbage for just like an hour.
Well, there was a lot of other stuff too. It wasn't just boxes of garbage.
Industrial waste.
Okay. I understand what you're saying. So Zach has a thing. Zach has actually never watched. Zach is like really intrigued by the premise of elements of Attack on Titan and has never watched it purely because, and this is understandable, but like he can't stand Brown.
I've watched plenty of Attack on Titan. I've just never finished it.
Well, you never finished it. Like, you watched through a couple episodes. Like, any show.
I've seen at least half the first season.
Okay.
Maybe more than that.
Like, well, my point is, Zach has an aversion to brown.
Yes. No, well, if your entire aesthetic is muddy brown and gray and green and ugly drab colors, unless you are fucking astonishingly interesting from a thematic or a story perspective, I'm going to check out. And Titan was interesting, but not that interesting. So I'm going to go back to it, though, because for a variety of reasons. Anyway, please go on.
Well, no, I was just saying Isle of Dogs has that, too. Well, like, so I don't have such an aversion to brown that if it's really beautiful, like I think Isle of Dogs and Attack on Titan can be, like,
There's gorgeous movies.
Yeah.
There's beautiful ones.
Well, I'm just saying, like, the Trash Island thing, like, Zach was not going to be on board. Like, I understand.
You could have executed it in a visually interesting way.
Mm-hmm. I thought
the scenes in Megasaki City, which is a good name for, that is a pretty good name. It sounds like it's from, like, Cyber City 08 or something like that. Those scenes looked really good, and frankly, the as much as I didn't like them, the haiku bits were visually arresting.
Right, like, because they had colors there. Although, yeah, the reason you didn't like the haiku bits,
the opening scene with the guy in the temple with the cat and everything, gorgeous. I was like, wow, look at this little miniature, everything, just amazing. And then it gets to Garbage Land, and it's Garbage Land for an hour, and it's these mangy, kind of ugly, not very cute dogs that all have kind of the same profile.
Like ugly dogs. Yeah. I like the ugly dogs.
Yeah, I know you like ugly dogs.
I like ugly animals. So, yeah.
That's why you married me.
No.
Okay. Anyway, boy, we got totally derailed. Pacific Rim has a Gundam model in it. There's a little cameo appearance by a Gundam model.
Oh.
And Daryl was saying, well, this is actually the first major cameo appearance by a Gundam, not Ready Player One, because technically Pacific Rim. Now I think Daryl kind of has a point. I think that any list would list that one first, maybe. But
is there not a smaller movie that a Gundam?
That's the thing that I'm thinking is surely there is at least.
Yeah, surely. Like,
but the thing is that if that existed, one of these guys who I was in conversation with or me would have brought it up. Like, I would have probably known about that, or they would have known about that. There might be another one. I can't imagine that there's literally no instance of a Gundam.
Yeah, like there's a bunch of little movies like Zero Charisma and stuff that just show nerd hovels. There's a Gundam in there.
Totally. So I think this is the way that the people who would care about such a thing would attend a panel, right? Attend a convention panel, Gundam's Hollywood appearances, and I would probably fucking go to that panel.
No, I know. I just that tickles me.
Well, but this is the context under which this is important, right? So that guy would say, like, okay, now you may know that in Pacific Rim Uprising there was this one shot with a Gundam model kit here in the background. However, the first major one was this scene from Ready Player One, and plays the clip. That's how that would go. Mm-hmm. Right?
Right.
So I think it can kind of have it both ways. Mm-hmm. I think both are true, and you would include both anytime you talk about it anyway.
Right.
So really, it's just a matter of which one you emphasize.
Right.
Let's see. Cyber Mormon asks, if you were the creator of the Oasis, what sort of obscure franchise references would you put in a quest to own it after you die? Whoa. Mine would be all centered around films like The Nutcracker 3D and The Love Guru. Terrible films that I nevertheless have some reason attached to over the years.
I'm gonna put in the gayest shit possible so that the queers will inherit the earth.
Yeah.
There we go. It's like, all right, this is a reference to a musical from the 1940s that was, you know, that kind
of
thing.
No, all of my shit would be absolutely harrowing, rigorous deep dive on your mental state, and they would all be tied to Evangelion. Like,
right. Why did I know? I knew.
Like, it would
just
turn your brain inside out.
Mm. Right. No, I wouldn't pick my favorite stuff. I would pick stuff with values that I thought, like, okay, this person's all right. They're well-rounded. They're not, like, entitled or, like, have a weird crusade. Like, I would pick stuff that, like, kind of maybe have a sense of humor about yourself and, like, learn something new and be open-minded.
They walk into a room. There's a crucifix, some nails, and a hammer. Mm-hmm. Nothing else.
Oh, for Christ's sake. Literally.
This is your challenge.
Oh, fuck. That's just Saw. Like, that's not even going anymore. That's just hostile or something.
All right. James Bailey asks, did Jake end up keeping up with How to Keep a Mummy?
Yes. It was very cute. That's There's not it. Much more to say than that.
Sit through 12 20-minute episodes of that?
Yeah.
Relaxing. How did it fill, let's say, episode 10?
There's a lot of jokes. It isn't just like this animal is cute. It's like they find things for them to do. If I had one of those, I would definitely have the Baku, cuz he's like round. He's just a round pig thing. And he eats your bad dreams. So he has, like, a practical purpose. The others don't have a practical purpose, but the Baku will eat your bad dreams, and he's snuggly. And you can use him as a pillow.
Sounds relaxing.
It was very relaxing. It's very charming.
Jacob, are you watching Cardcaptor Sakura?
Yeah, I think I'm a little behind because it's slow, because it's Cardcaptor Sakura, but yeah.
Okay, CC Takao asks, any fan theories on who Akiho is and what her goals are?
I think that's probably, you can't make fan theories necessarily because it's, like, in the manga already. It's revealed, right? So, like, but, I mean, she just doesn't have memories, and she's actually, like, the dark mage in Sakura's Nightmare. She's taking her shit or whatever. Like, I couldn't be arsed to care, to be honest with you. It's gonna reveal what it is, and it's not gonna be terribly, like, it's not gonna be terribly surprising. Like, you know, it's a children's show for Clamp where they kind of gave you all the details.
I feel like every now and then I just want someone to tell me, like, oh yeah, they leased a new apartment on Cardcaptor Sakura this week or something like that. Like, oh yeah, she got a new car. It's really
30s.
Nice. Very excited about it. Mm-hmm. Just these mundane details. Like, let's see. Carl Olson says, are they ever getting to the fireworks factory in Darling in the Franxx? I hope so. If they don't, fuck it, I really wasted a lot of time. I just need them to get to a fireworks factory. I don't need it to be mine. It just has to be one of them.
They'll 100% get there. I just don't know what it's going to be, you know.
Patrick Jones asks, if Devilman Crybaby was aired weekly, would any of you be talking about Darling in the Franxx? I feel like people latched onto this because there's no other big thematic shows to latch onto because Devilman came out all at once. You know, that's actually not a bad little analysis. Who knows if it had gone differently? I guarantee you it would have been fucking flipping out about Devilman every week.
Yeah.
I'm still flipping out about Devilman every week.
No, I want an excuse to revisit it, but I don't have the time. It's just like, oh, yeah. It's so good.
No, over the summer, I think. Maybe actually near Halloween, I think, is going to be Devil. I'm going to save it. I'm going to save it for a near Halloween.
I still religiously listen to the not the theme song, but the theme song, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. No, yes. Yeah.
It's real.
I really like the closing credits. So I have that a lot. I listen to that a lot. Yeah. No, I don't think you're wrong. I would definitely still be talking about Darling in the Franxx. I don't underestimate my willingness to go in on an Ava alike.
Right.
Just don't. I will do it. Much to the chagrin of many. Michael Leone asks, have you already pre-purchased your tickets for Avengers? No, my friend. That's what MoviePass is for. What do you think of the new Deadpool trailer? I didn't watch it, because I'll probably watch Deadpool 2, and I don't need to see any of the jokes ahead of time. Mm-hmm. I liked Deadpool fine. The original, the first one. It was fine. It was funny. But that was, everybody thought that. Like, you actually thought it was okay. You didn't hate it.
Yeah, well, I a lot of the jokes are pretty mean-spirited, which I wasn't into, but
not as bad as it could have been.
No, yeah, but no, absolutely. Like, it was nowhere near as bad as it could have been. The timing on everything was really good. So it wasn't, you know, the stuff that I objected to was just, like, bro joke, you know. It's like, I'm not into the super broiest bro humor, so.
Yeah.
But it was, yeah, it was fine. It was good.
Divorced Seven Times asks, hope this doesn't come off as a jerk question, but where does all the hope for Franxx come from? Don't worry, it's not a jerk question. That's a very reasonable question. Every time I hear about it, it's massively disappointing. Why are folks so ready for it to be an amazing subversive show? Well,
I don't think that's what people are hoping for.
Nah, well, I am hoping that it does something else with its time, but right. Or does something interesting, or, you know, there's a chance it could. I articulated that earlier in the show, but look, I think this is a case where, like, I like to engage with shows that do this kind of thing. I just do. It doesn't mean it's going to happen every single time, or that, it's something that happens by knee jerk or whatever. It's just like, the show is still giving us plenty to talk about. And if you like to talk about that stuff and want to try to figure it out and are still going along for the ride, you know, it's interesting.
Plus, I mean, you can't underestimate, like, people's desire to see a new mech show, and B, like, an original anime production.
Yeah, right. No one can tell me where this is going.
So, like, yeah, and so both of those things, people, it's not that people think it's going to be amazing. They're just like, oh, I'm watching this because we don't get these every day.
Yeah.
And I'm just kind of, even if it's bad, like, it's entertaining and I'm enjoying my time with it.
Yeah, I think that the thing that everybody, and I try to be careful about this, is you kind of have to sort of rein in the verbiage that you use. If it's 26 episodes and the thing is giving you some bombastic thing to complain about every week, you kind of got to rein it in a little bit. Otherwise, it's just like 26 weeks of hammering on this fucking thing. It's exhausting, right? Uh-huh. Like, it's exhausting to hear. I get exhausted by it.
Mm-hmm.
I empathize with that. I get exhausted by, like, oh, I can't believe what Darling in the Franxx did this week. Like, yeah, it gets fucking, and you're like, okay, just stop fucking watching it. You know, like, I totally empathize with that. But it is fun and enriching to engage with something that's trying to do something and engage with it on its own terms and try to be smart about it and think about what it's really saying to you. Like, that is how I like to engage with stuff. So that's kind of why. It's a little complicated.
Right.
Let's see. Anonymous asks, do you think the strong implication that Ikuno and Mitsuru are LGBT is an indication that Franxx does have something to say about gender issues and roles?
It has something to say. We just don't know what it is.
Yeah. It's like sitting in the corner going, I'm going to tell you what I really think in a minute. And you're like, could you just fucking get to it already so I can leave?
Like, the queer characters are just a nice, like, oh, okay, you're living in 2018. Like, that's just a nice, like, but it obviously had something to say about gender from the minute it showed these robots are piloted by doggy style and they're called Pistol and Stamens. Like, it had something to say from that moment forward. You know, it's like, well, I just don't know what it is yet.
Let's see. Lamarama Yasha asks, Isle of Dogs with Japanese setting felt like window dressing to me. It didn't seem to relate to the film's story and themes beyond being a neat aesthetic. Yep. That's the other thing.
Yeah.
There's no fucking reason for that movie to be set in Japan.
Uh-huh.
How would you have changed the setting to better complement the story, or at least make it feel more thematically relevant? That's a good question. I don't think the story had much going for it to begin with. It is kind of a really sort of shallow fascism thing that is, you know, yes, this it is an accurate portrayal, especially of the way that fascism functions, but it is also sort
not the
of
way it resolves.
Not the way it definitely not the way it resolves, and is very a cartoonish oversimplification. So, I don't know that he had a strong story idea here to begin with, and kind of want him to go back to the drawing board. So I don't think there is much you could have done with this. The whole thing didn't appeal to me.
Right.
I am here for your fucking fascism metaphors. I am here for them, man. I am lining up for those. But unless you're like this in this day and age, I think everyone who's touching on that stuff has a responsibility to be like educated and presenting it in a way that really is going to get through to people and not just be like, here's the same cartoon you've seen about fascism over and over and over again.
Yeah.
So
it was my reaction on reflection to Isle of Dogs is mostly just like, Wes Anderson just thought this was cute and nobody told him no, or nobody told him workshop it. Like, I'm sure somebody did at some point, but it feels more than his other movies. Like, he just went with his first idea and everybody said it was really good and he didn't change it. You know?
Yeah. That's what it seemed like. Okay. You know what? Actually, that is our last question. Thank you all for sending them in. And Jacob, thanks for hanging out.
Yeah, always happy to be here.
Yo, we'll see y'all next week. Okay, that's our show. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check them out at newdivisionmusic.com. Don't forget, subscribe to us on Google Play Music, Stitcher Radio, iTunes, YouTube, all those places. Leave us ratings and reviews. It really helps us out. We love you so much when you do it. Thank you so much. We'll see you all next week.